Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 1096. Just a little shameless self-promotion. The Talking Dead is on this Sunday. That would be October 4th. It's the what was going to be the season 10 finale of Walking Dead is finally going to air, followed by the series premiere of Walking Dead World Beyond, and then a Talking Dead. If you're following the Walking Dead news, you probably heard that the season 10 episode that was going to be the finale is not the season finale anymore. They're going to be bonus episodes of season 10, followed by the season 11 of Walking Dead, which will be an extended season. So it's we talk about it all on Talking Dead. If you don't watch Walking Dead, then your brain shut off while listening to this anyway, so it doesn't matter to you. But if you are a Walking Dead fan, Sunday we'll cover all of it. We'll talk about Walking Dead, we'll talk about World Beyond, we'll talk about plans for the spinoffs, all the news that's been in the news about The Walking Dead. So that will be Sunday starting at 9 p.m. 8 Central on AMC. All right. This is from Andrew, who writes to the corkboard, events at id10t.com, the ID10T community corkboard. Andrew says, I've always had a story in my head and wanted to put pen to paper, but always found some excuse not to do it. But I finally took your advice a few years ago and decided to make a thing. The result, Teddy the Time Traveler and the Statue of Liberty. That's a great title. That is a fantastic title, Andrew. And I feel like it gives you a sense of what it's about, but I will read on. The book is aimed at elementary age children and mixes the world of time travel with historical fiction. The first book travels back to 1860s Paris and New York. Teddy's life is in shambles after the mysterious disappearance of his father a year ago. His mother is working constantly and his best friend has also disappeared. On top of it all, a bully won't leave him alone at school. The fourth grade is terrible. The book is available in paperback and ebook on Amazon and in select bookstores. And Andrew, thank you so much for writing in. Events at id10t.com. Will you be the next Andrew who makes a thing and then shares it on the community corkboard? I don't know. I can't answer that. This episode is Jane Seymour, who is in a film in theaters now called The War with Grandpa. It's an amazing cast. It's her and Robert De Niro and Christopher Walken and Cheech Marin and Rob Riggle and Uma Thurman. So that is in theaters now. And this podcast, what an amazing conversation I got to have with her. She is just such an amazing human being, does so many different things, you know, is an actor, a producer, a painter, a dancer, does a lot of amazing charity work. And this really was such an inspirational conversation. You know, Jane, as you'll soon discover, is really just a person who just gets things done, you know, lives in the moment. Follows the things that she's passionate about, focuses on contribution, and just knows how to turn obstacles into opportunities. So I really honestly am so appreciative that I got to spend an hour talking with her. I learned a lot. I listened back and I made notes. So thank you a million times to Jane Seymour for being such a wonderful guest on this episode of the ID10T podcast, which is number 1096 with Jane Seymour.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
Have you done podcasts before?
Yes.
Good.
I think I have. Obviously not yours, but...
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah, I have actually. Various friends of mine decided to become podcasters, so I've been podcasting with them. I think it's very cool. My son introduced me to podcasts when we went on a road trip. It's a cool thing. Very cool.
It is. Well, and also I feel like a lot more people are doing podcasts now because... in a relative state of quarantine, people are like, well, I don't know what to do. All right, well, I guess I'll just make a podcast.
Yeah, there you go.
Where are you right now? Are you in the UK?
I'm in Malibu.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, if I turn this around, you can see what I'm looking at.
Oh, that's gorgeous. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so it's not bad. It's not bad at all, yeah.
Did you feel the earthquake last night in Malibu?
Do you know what? Just the tiniest thing. It was just, I have one of those beds that, you know, goes up and down that seems like a good idea and vibrates if you want it to. But I've never used it and I don't even know where the clicker is. And I thought, oh, I wonder if somebody accidentally trod on the clicker, but there's no one in my room. So, and then I thought, what if it's an earthquake? What are we going to do? And then I thought, maybe we'll just put the covers over our heads and hope for the best. So, and of course, it was an earthquake. No, we didn't feel it, not in Malibu. I think it went all the way up to Santa Monica, but not here.
Yeah, that's it. It was like 11:45 at night or something. And my wife and I both jumped out of bed. And like, I've lived in LA for 30 years and I still don't exactly know what to do. I'm like, do we stand under the door jamb? I don't know what we're supposed to. I guess we just
door jamb or a large table, but nowhere near a tree. I know that.
No, don't go. You're not supposed to run outside, apparently, because things can fall on you.
Yeah, I know. It was definitely, you know, it reminded me that I've got to pay some attention to that. Whereabouts do you guys live?
We're kind of in the like near Griffith Park.
Oh, so, you were near where it happened, right?
Oh yeah.
In the right direction.
Yeah. My mom lives in Pasadena, and she said she's normally not scared of earthquakes, and she said it just like almost knocked her out of bed. So it was it was pretty intense there. Okay. In general, how are you doing? Are you okay? Are you good? Have you been traveling? Have you stayed put? How are you?
Well, you know, I think I can admit to it now, but I didn't dare at the time. But I'm fairly social. I love to see my grandkids. I love to see my kids. My partner got incredibly nervous about everything and, you know, the masks. And I'd just come back from Spain where COVID was really bad. And I got out of there one day before it got really, really bad. I think I'd had a bit of a flu while I was there. And it turns out that I probably have the antibodies. So I must have had some version of COVID when I was there without really realizing it. But, you know, sometimes I get a flu and the first thing I do is I get steroids and antibiotics because I know that I can't afford to go to bronchitis. So that usually stops it. But I was fine. I didn't miss a moment. I was playing Eleanor of Aquitaine. It was freezing cold. I remember that. And I was in a castle, a medieval castle. So anyway, I got back. He locked himself off. And my house is two stories. He locked himself off, locked doors, wouldn't even go in the garden. He just thought if you went in the garden, the virus could find you. And I'm just like, one of my sons, a 24-year-old son, who's a rock musician, had just moved back from Nashville after being gone 4 years. He's making music here and he built himself a studio. And so it was the two of us and then my boyfriend downstairs. And then we looked at one another one day and friends of ours said, why don't you come to Wyoming? And this friend of ours has very compromised health. He survived, you know, 4 bouts of cancer. And he said, come. And I said, really? He said, yes. So I got into the car I never drive, the Suburban. I did what I've never done, which is a road trip. I got my daughter and the children. They came separately in their own car. We all met up there. We had a road trip going there. We then went off on our other road trips. I went to national parks, joined the national parks, never been to Yellowstone, never been to any of these things, never been to the Grand Canyon, did all of it, saw a fire starting at the Grand Canyon, talked to the fire brigade and escaped that. I mean, that's just for starters. Then I went to Australia and starred in a movie. Everyone said, are you crazy? You're going on an airplane? I went, yes. And they only allowed 50 people on the airplane, not 300. Wow. Plus airplane. I never saw anyone. They kind of locked me in there. I arrived, you know, masked. The military, the police with machine guns took us one at a time, processed us, put us into this room, kind of locked you up there for 2 weeks. That was kind of weird, very weird. Discovered Uber Eats while I was there. Talking to people when you're in Australia, it's good. The good news is your time zone is such that you can talk to your family in England and your family in America because someone's always awake when you're still. Right. So I did that great movie about Alzheimer's and it was great. Never got sick. No one got sick. It was perfect. Came back here. As I said, we meet people outdoors. We grow all our own food and fruit and vegetables. We have chickens. It's just been amazing. I'm doing a lot of nonprofit work for my charity, for Open Hearts Foundation. I have been painting on Zoom with old people in old people's homes in Dallas. That
oh, wow.
I painted with a lady who had ALS, was on hospice, died 3 weeks later, and lasted much longer than they'd expected. And she painted 20 paintings before she'd passed.
Oh, my gosh.
So I then did an online art auction, and all the money we raised, $75,000, went to COVID charities for women and children. I have not stopped, to be honest. And I'm going back to Spain in 2 weeks. I'm booking my ticket as we speak. I leave, I think, on the 3rd or 4th of October. I'll be gone for 3 weeks playing Eleanor again in Spain in medieval castles. Then I come back and do Kominsky Method. I'm doing the press right now for War with Grandpa. I have another movie coming out in October and November called Friendsgiving with Malin Ackerman and Kat Dennings, which I'm starring in, which is just is going to come out. And then go back to Kominsky. And then next year, I'm due to go to Ireland and England to do a wonderful series that's been written for me. It's an 8 one-hour piece for streaming, and very exciting. So, yes, I'm crazy busy.
You're the busiest person I've talked to during this quarantine. You got busy. Somehow you got, it sounds like busier.
I don't know why. And I'm a designer and I paint. So I've been painting, very prolific painter. When they quarantined me, I had my paints with me in Australia. So I just kept decorating the walls behind me with paintings. And yes, I am. My agent told me at one point I was literally the only person the entire agency was working. And I said, that's really funny, isn't it? Because most actresses at 40, their careers are over. I'm about to be 70 and I've never been busier.
Well, so everything that you just described, there's so many things that I want to ask you about. I got to remember that. But it sounds like, and at least in the way that you describe it, that you just kind of roll with whatever happens. Whatever's going on, it doesn't seem to bother you. I mean, maybe it bothers you, but you don't let it stop you, which I think is the important thing. Being bothered is one thing, but letting it stop you is another. So is this a skill set that you cultivated over time, or have you always just, are you just innately that way?
Well, first of all, you know, my mother survived 3.5 years in the camps in Indonesia.
Right.
I grew up with a mother for whom, you know, if someone says, no, you can't, she did it. my mother lived her life to the fullest, whether she, you know, lost her eyesight or her hearing or had arthritis, nothing stopped her ever. And so I'm a bit like that. Plus, a number of years ago, I had a near-death experience in Spain, actually, in Madrid, where I had an injection of cephalosporin, an antibiotic, and it missed a muscle and went into a vein. I had anaphylactic shock, and I died, and I was resuscitated. So after that happened, my whole life changed, because I realized that dying didn't hurt, that when you died, you left your body and you could actually see and hear everything that was happening. And of course, if you're resuscitated like I was, you now can tell people what happened because you were there. Right. And you could see and hear what they were doing, you know, even once you're pronounced not being there anymore. And I think I just love life so much that I don't live in the past. I live in the present. And I live in the what can I do rather than what can't I do. So I know I can protect myself by being healthy. I know I can protect myself and others by wearing a mask. I know I can make a difference if I vote. I know I can't win. Nobody's going back to anything. There is no back to. It is a reset in life. And I think life is a reset every day of our lives anyway. Some of us more privately than others. And sometimes, you know, it's a global reset. And you have to hope that, you know, that people are being as responsible as they can be and do what they can do to help others. And I have noticed that there are an enormous number of people, especially younger people, that really want to volunteer their skill set. They want it's a what can I do world. Yeah. My daughter, Katie, who's 38, started a nonprofit with, under our nonprofit, it's a swiping, like a dating site, but it's for volunteering. So
It's
called Young Hearts, and it's brilliant. You know, you swipe this way or that way. But basically, it's very exciting. We're about to, you know, put it out very soon. We've been working it for a while, but because of COVID and everything, but it is going to happen. And the idea is that you put in your skill set and, you know, your location and what you care about. And then the organization put what they're looking for, what they do, and that everyone's vetted. So, you know, you then decide if you want to connect with them or not. So rather than, you know, sitting back and saying, there's nothing I can do, you maybe you're a paralegal or a lawyer and, you know, there's some people dealing with immigration issues that can't afford a lawyer and don't know how to read a form. Or maybe, you know, you speak a couple of languages and you can translate for somebody. Or you know how to cook and or you know how to help kids learn how to work, you know, to study on Zoom. Whatever it is, people can volunteer and make a difference. And it makes me very excited because there is, I'm always looking at what is the now and what is the future. I think what we've learned is that we actually need one another. And we need to communicate, whether it's listening to podcasts or creating podcasts or talking on the phone or Zooming or, you know, talking to grandchildren, you know, and I think this has sort of closed up the generation gap a bit. You know, the older folks like myself are learning how to use these funny things called computers. And the younger ones are now finally allowed to because their parents are going, oh, my God, well, they're doing it for school anyway. Let them talk to the grandparents. And so it's a different world. It's a very scary world. But then, you know, it's always been a scary world. And there I'm going off to play Eleanor of Aquitaine. When you read the history of what was going on there where – you know, the Christians are murdering the Muslims, the Muslims are the Jews, and the Jews, you know, everybody's fighting over one piece of land. Guess what? They still are, right? And you know, sort of lots of issues of women's rights and dictators and family squabbles and, you know, someone like St. Francis of Assisi. Every time I do a movie, I go, wow, we never learned, did we?
Well, and you know, we think, oh, we study history so that we don't repeat the mistakes of the past. And then it's like, well, okay, well, then we'll make new mistakes, but then also repeat a bunch. I mean, it does seem very cyclical.
I mean, when I did Dr. Quinn, for example, I would learn my lines. I'd go to work. I'd be in makeup. I'd look at the cover of whatever newspaper was out there and it would say mercury poisoning, you know, in Colorado from the gold mines from the 1800s. And go, that's our episode. That's
oh my gosh. Right.
And then and that's the cover story of the LA Times, you know, and that was, would have been what, 26 years ago. So yeah, it is pretty wild. I think, you know, communication, people learning, I think one of the upsides of the downsides of what's happening right now is people are actually taking time out to study, to learn, to listen. I'm not sure what their sources are sometimes, but, you know, the internet is a fairly fascinating place. And I think, as with everything in life, you've got to be a discerning user.
Yes, but also, you know, another thing that you said that I think is so important is this app that your daughter's developing, and you're talking about, you know, people getting out and getting connected and being and giving back. And I think, you know, that sense of contribution is vital, not only from a societal standpoint, but I think the mentally healthiest people tend to contribute more. And I can't help but think that it's because they're just not focused on themselves as much.
Exactly. And, you know, that was my mother's whole adage. She said, darling, if things are really tough, she said, accept it's the hardest thing to do. Open your heart and reach out to help someone else. Then you'll have purpose. When you have purpose in life, she said, your problems eventually sort themselves out. But when you're able to help someone else, trust me, there is always someone worse off than you. You don't have to look very far.
Wow, that's incredible. That's really incredible. My mom has said the same thing to me. And I think, you know, I feel like we are lucky to have that in our lives, because that something like that is just so influential. And I'm sure because everything that you said you're doing, half of it was work and half of it was volunteering, it sounds like. Yeah. In the past. Yeah,
absolutely. And I mean, the movie I did in Australia was all about Alzheimer's and about, you know, a woman who doesn't know she has Alzheimer's, inadvertently burns down her house, doesn't realize that her husband is dead. And when she gets to have to forced to go and live with her own daughter, she doesn't really know what's going on and all kinds of crazy stuff happens. But by the end of the piece, she makes a choice as to what happens in her life. And she completely, radically, and beautifully changes the life of every member of her family. So all their issues, everything, inadvertently, she has helped them all. So it's an uplifting story, if they can be one, about about dementia and Alzheimer's. And you know, one of the reasons I did it is the man who is making it is giving half the profits to Foundation for Alzheimer's and Dementia.
That's really wonderful. But I also, you know, I'm also curious when you say, because I'm not saying it's easy to do all the time, but living in the present really does seem to be the key, sort of, you know, mindfulness and not living the past or the future. But it's the idea of what do you do when the present is terrifying, you know, like when you can live in the present, you go, shit, the present is a scary place.
It's true. But you see, I can't control the next 10 seconds.
Right.
Right. I couldn't control the earthquake that you felt last night.
Right.
There was nothing I could have done to make a difference to that. What I can do is now say to myself, oh, well, maybe I need to prepare myself and think about what I would do if that happens again. I remember after 9/11, just watching the ticker tape and just watching these terrible images and just going, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my God, the world's coming to an end. Well, the world didn't come to an end. It was devastating. It changed the world forever. Absolutely. And then I was asked to go off and make a movie, and no one wanted to make a movie straight after 9/11. No one wanted to get an airplane. I was one of three people in an airplane after that happened, because I spoke to my mom and I said, what do I do? Do I stay home? And she said, no, darling. She said, you know, you can't live in fear. You know, you just never know. And she told me a story about a friend of hers who lived in fear. She had never driven in a car. She had never done anything dangerous ever in her life. She'd never flown an airplane or gone in a boat or, you know, done a sport or anything like that. And she was 50 years old. She'd get out of her house. She'd be very safe. She'd go to the bus stop. She'd get on the same bus. She'd go three stops, get off. She did that every day of her life. One day the bus came, it jumped the curb and killed her.
Oh, my God.
So my mother said, really? Like, really? She never lived a life. Never. This woman never had a life.
Yeah.
Only thing that could get her was, you know.
You can't control if a bus is going to jump a curb and hit you. It's interesting. There's this. There's a cartoon I saw the other day, and there's two people kind of looking at a sunset, and one says, well, you only live once. And the other person said, no, you only die once. You live every day. And
that's very true.
That was very impactful, because I go, oh yeah, of course. Like if you live in fear all the time, you're really kind of suffering multiple times, you know?
And you know something, I think most people do live in fear because people fear change. And I have a whole philosophy about this if you want to hear it. So,
I do.
So we, none of us choose who we're going to be born to or when or where or how or what our circumstances are. It's a given. It's what you're an egg and then you're a child. And I think of it like being in a body of water, whether it's an ocean and a wave, you know, you're in a big body of water, you're one of many. And suddenly it's that woohoo moment where, you know, the wave crests, you win the prize, you first kiss, you fall in love, you make the team, whatever it is. It's like, and then it comes down. Well, for most people, when it comes down, that they quit and they just go, oh, that's it. No, that's too painful. I'm never doing that again. I'm not meant to do that, whatever it is. But if you think about a wave, it doesn't go straight down and stay there. It curves. It comes down with some velocity. It scrapes the bottom. So, yes, it hurts. And then it comes straight. It continues moving. It doesn't stop anywhere. It keeps going up. It now has the experience of the highs, the letting go, the survival of the scrape. And if your heart and your mind are open, it will meet new water and create a new wave. And that's how I see life. So it's really about how you handle change. I think that is the secret to living a full life. How do you deal with change? How do you embrace it? And how do you know what you can do to make a difference and what you can't?
Wow, that's such an incredible metaphor, and it does at its core what it's teaching you is like it's never over until it's over, you know. And so just because something crashes down, you're right, doesn't mean that right around the corner is another wave that's going to pick you up. But you know, I think as we get older, you can go one of two ways. You get hurt a lot, and then you go, well, I don't ever want to get hurt again. Or you go, well, I've been hurt, so I'm not scared of that anymore, and I'm just going to keep learning and keep growing. But it is a lot of effort. And I feel like it is, you know, to try to escape discomfort is sort of the core of our culture, I think. And so I feel like it fights a basic survival instinct that we have, maybe, you know? So it's just...
Very true. And you hear about so many people who have back pain or this pain or that pain. I think if you can find a way to acknowledge and just say, yes, I'm hearing you, pain. I hear you. You do whatever you can do to not exacerbate it, and then find something other than thinking about your pain to focus on, for, you know, whether it's meditation or it's whatever it is, some sort of a distraction, or, you know, finding a different way of doing something. You can really heal yourself in many ways. I think it's people that hang on to past hurt, past illness, past resentments, past trauma. It's past.
Yeah.
It happened. And that doesn't mean it doesn't hurt and it isn't going to affect your life. But, you know, you can recognize it and bit by bit find a way to let go of it and move forward. Or you can hang on to it for dear life and say, well, this is what I know, this is who I am, this is how I identify, and you'd better feel sorry for me because I do. But I'm right. I'm not that person.
Well, that's good, because it's...
I'm like, next.
that's really good, because it you can get... It's so easy to get caught in these sort of cul-de-sacs of the past, and then, you know, it's like if you're looking in the back, you can't look forward, and then you won't see new opportunities, and then at a certain point, it's like you're trapping yourself there for some reason. Do you want to be there? Do you want to hurt, or are you ready to move on? And I think sometimes it does take that, even that simple acknowledgement of like, I'm done, I'm ready to move on now.
Yeah. And I think actually was interesting, as you know, in this movie, the War with Grandpa movie, because yeah. You think about it, you know, something, I mean, we can all identify with, you know, you love someone for a very long time and you lose them. You know, your life is, what is your life? Your life is about being connected to someone else, and you've lost that connection. Now what? You know, and I think loneliness and depression are the hardest things in the world.
Yeah.
But you can be very lonely in a very big family house if you choose to be.
Right.
You can be lonely in a huge world with millions of people if you choose to be. Or you can connect, and you don't need to connect with that many. Just, you know, one's fine. Could be a dog or a cat, too.
I'm so curious if you're willing to talk about it, and if you're not, I completely understand. But the near-death experience that you had, you really did have that sense. You said, you can see yourself and you're sort of floating away. Was there something that pulled you back, or did it just happen?
No, I saw, you know, after the injection thing, I could feel my throat close, my heart beating too fast. It was like a loud noise in my chest going, ba-dum, 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 and then suddenly silence, complete peace, like peace like I've never experienced other than when I try to do meditation, but even beyond, like complete peace. And I saw this white light, and I just thought, oh, that's, you know, peeling. And then I looked down, it was as if I was the corner of a room, and I looked down and I saw this body that looked like me, and I've seen myself in movies, so I know what I look like. And there I am, and there's this man screaming and yelling in Spanish, emergency, ambulancia, emergency. And now I'm my naked backside and the two huge syringes, and he's screaming, yelling on the phone. And then it's almost like you're floating around the room, and I could see there was a syringe with blood in it. Oh. And then I remember looking back up at the white light, and I'm not of any specific spiritual belief system, you know. Mm-hmm. Not, you know, I'm very kind of open-minded about a lot of that. But I do feel connected to the spirit of whatever there is in terms of mankind. I do feel that. And I remember just saying, well, if I can, I want to get back in that body, because I have kids that I want to raise, and I will not waste my time. I want to make a difference. And so when I eventually got back in my body, obviously cortisone and adrenaline is what got me back. My body was shaking, and they were just, you know, the producers there saying, oh, she's being hysterical. She's afraid of the role. She doesn't want to play this part. Well, I actually ended up winning the Emmy as best actress for it. So he was kind of wrong about that. No, I was not faking. They, you know, insurance stopped, came the next day, and all the way from England said, you know, I knew you've never missed a day's work in your entire life, and looked at my hip and said, you had anaphylactic shock and you'll live now, but you were nearly not here. And after the first day or two where I was afraid to close my eyes, because I thought if I closed my eyes, I'd leave my body.
Of course.
And my bless her, my sister, my middle sister who worked for the airlines, you know, on the ground, she just quit her job and came to Madrid and lay in bed next to me and held me and just was there with me for a week. And then I realized that you only take two things with you when you die, and that is the love you've shared in your life and the difference you've made. That's all you take.
Oh, my God. You don't take
anything else. And it was like an incredible awakening. It was like, okay, so that's what it is. It's about loving and being loved, whether it's for a minute or a lifetime, whether it's a partner or a child or a friend or a dog or whatever it is. Yeah. And it's about the difference you've made. You know, did you impact anyone's life at any time? Or did you make a difference somehow? Did you use your time to do something that you uniquely could do during the time that you had? That's it. That was my motivation. That's why I started my nonprofit Open Hearts Foundation. You know, Christopher Reeve had a terrible accident. We used to have long conversations about, you know, how terrible it was. But at the same time, one point he felt it wasn't worth living anymore. And then he realized that actually he was motivated to change things for people like him. And he did. And she said, you know, the funny thing is, you know, when I die, people won't remember me as an actor or even Superman. They'll remember me for, you know, what I did.
Anyway. I mean, that's a really incredible story about Christopher Reeve, and that it, and I mean, do you feel like he was able to, I don't even know what the right word is.
I'll tell you what I learned from him. I learned that you go through stages of, you know, why me? And is this the quality of life that I want? And then in his case, you know, his wife basically said, you know, whatever's your choice, but as far as I'm concerned, you are still you. So he wrote this beautiful book called Still Me. And I think he tried, you know, some sort of religion or something, and then got out of that and realized that that he had left a lot of people in the rehab whose families and insurance companies had all abandoned them. And they were just sitting there looking at a wall, just wishing they weren't there anymore. And at that time, there was no cure or even research for spinal regeneration. And you know, he got involved with stem cells, and he, you know, spoke in Congress, and he, you know, I mean, the guy couldn't breathe, move or anything, or do anything by himself. And he just moved mountains. And I remember, you know, talking to him, and he said the hardest thing for him was that when he was asleep at night and when he was in his dreams, especially just before he would wake up, he would be flying an aeroplane, jumping a horse, sailing in the middle of the ocean all by himself. And then he'd wake up to this noise of machines that were running his body and people who were, you know, dealing with the machines and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And the hardest part was that he could never really be on his own, because these people would come to work and they were fantastic and they were wonderful people, but they'd bring their outside problems with them. And he ended up really realizing that they needed him because they needed to be heard. And he was a sitting duck. He couldn't go anywhere.
Oh my God.
And he couldn't very well say, shut up, you know, leave me alone. I don't want you to talk to me about your problems you're having with your husband or whatever. But, and then I remember him telling me that the hardest thing in the world was not the paralysis. It is depression. And he said, that is the worst thing in the world. So he said, you know, mental depression. He said that That is the toughest one of all. So when you go down that dark tunnel and you just can't climb out. And, you know, I think it's very interesting because I think people are finally really talking more openly about that kind of disease. And I think with what's going on in the world right now, you know, it's become more, it's exacerbated it, and it's become more apparent. And, you know, people, you know, I've heard from many people who've been through terrible things and paralysis and this, that, and the other, and blindness. And every one of them has said to me, the worst thing is depression, especially chemical depression.
Well, and I know, like, my dad's generation just didn't, they didn't really talk about those things. It was sort of the walk it off generation. Like, oh, what do you need to see a therapist for? What are you, crazy? And it's like, I'm glad that stigma has, I feel like that stigma has largely dissipated, because I see a lot of conversations around mental health, and I think they're especially so important after, you know, in the midst of, and then even after the pandemic, I feel like we'll be dealing with the fallout of the mental fallout. And so I really hope that people do continue to talk, and they aren't afraid to ask for help if they need it, and connect with other people, because it's so vitally important.
And that connecting is everything. And, you know, that's what I learned from the near death. That's what I've learned from doing this. You know, it's all about connection. And, you know, if once a day I would just pick up the phone, especially when I was in Australia and I was in quarantine, I thought, well, if I can't see anyone, I can now at last I have time to talk to my girlfriend that I haven't spoken to in years, who we went to school together, and see how she's doing. And, you know, and another friend who's had a stroke, you know, it's I've got time to talk to him. And, you know, another friend of mine who's been going through cancer, just see how she's doing. And, you know, and another friend who's on their own because they're terrified and their kids are terrified and no one can visit them. It's just amazing. And that's part of this volunteer app idea is you can be, you can do enormous great things for people just by picking up the phone and talking to them and just say, hey, how are you doing? How's your day? You know?
Well, you also have so many outlets, so many things that you do. I mean, the painting alone, I would imagine, is an incredible outlet. Like if you just painted, you would have a wonderful outlet. What's some of your creative process when you're painting? Do you sort of approach it like, I sit down, there's a blank canvas, what it's just stream of consciousness, whatever comes out, or do you sort of plan and get ideas about what you want to tackle?
All of the above depends on the day. I would imagine that, you know, if I was a musician, I'd either decide I wanted to learn a Beatles song, or I'd come up with my own, you know,
right.
Or I just, you know, come up with a riff and just go, I'm really enjoying this, or I want to try something else. But no, I like to experiment, but I do everything from drawing with small children to drawing with people who tell me they can't paint or draw, and turning them onto it. And that's one of my most favorite things to do, is to talk to people and do, like, you know, I call it the squiggle game, where you get a pen, a Sharpie, and you close your eyes and you have your piece of paper in front of you and you put your pen down and you just move it around wherever you feel like according to your mood, or wherever that hand takes you with the pen. And then you, when you're finished, you take it off and now you look at it, turn it around any direction you like. And now you get to color it in, decorate it, alter it. You know, that's just the basis of something, because I think most people are afraid of a blank page. And, you know, if you're, you know, dealing with, well, this is a random piece of movement that just came out, now they turn it into things. And I love doing that with people. I've had such amazing times. And then, you know, when people start drawing or painting, or even when you show them how to do it properly, or watercolor or oils or palette knife or pastels, whatever it is, you know, people really kind of get into a zen state, and then they start talking like we're having this conversation. One of the things I really want to do, and I'm hoping to do soon, is a show where I paint or draw with someone that doesn't necessarily normally do that.
I was going to ask you if you thought about doing, like, a, you know, a painting show or a Bob Ross style show or something.
That, I, But Bob Ross is showing you exactly how to do it with the Happy Tuesday. I mean, actually, I am on the Bob Ross introduction, believe it or not. Somehow he got me to do that a long time ago. Okay. But no, a whole different thing. I think more like what you're doing, you know, talking and creating at the same time.
And getting people to unlock their own voice, their own creative.
Yeah. So I've already pitched the idea. I have a company that wants to do it. So, you know, that might happen. And that all came out of the pandemic. That all came out of finding myself painting with seniors and people with disabilities. So, yeah, that's where it came.
Do you, that, by the way, I would watch that show. I would legitimately watch that show because it's fun to watch. Not only is it fun to watch process, but it's also fun to watch people discover their own process. I mean, it in a way, it's sort of like the artistic version of a home renovation show where someone is kind of shown their vision. It's like, oh, I do have a vision. I can express things. I really hope, you know, even if they're like 15-minute episodes or hour-long episodes, whatever they are, I hope you're able to do that.
Well, I'm intending to shoot the pilot as soon as I find a celebrity that is willing to do a pilot with me. So I hope to do it when I get back from Spain in November. But I've been, you know, doing it with lots of people anyway. But yeah, I think it's going to be really, really fun to do it. And, you know, and you could even do it over Zoom if you had to. You know, you don't have to physically be together, but I think it'd be cool to be in the same place. And I think by then, hopefully, we'll be more COVID careful and, you know, be able to, you know, do things, be close enough to one another, but also, you know, have space. It's a really different time, you know. I think one of the things I do like about what's happened is people aren't jumping on airplanes for no reason. So that's got to help the planet, number one. And, you know, all these business people that kept going somewhere, you know, staying in a hotel, taking the, you know, changing airplanes just to do what? To have a business meeting that they could have easily on Zoom.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, and also, you know, it's these types of situations where life kind of steps in to reset your priorities. And in your case, it was a near-death experience. And, you know, we talked a little bit about Christopher Reeve and in this case, you know, a pandemic. Yeah, because when you're young, you just, you know, I mean, I don't know, when you were young, I would imagine you probably thought, oh, acting is the ultimate thing. And you have this near-death experience. You go, I mean, at that point, did you go, oh, maybe acting doesn't mean everything anymore. Maybe I can do it because I like to, not because it defines me or it's something that I have to do.
Well, actually, the interesting thing is I think a lot of people feel that what they do defines them. And I think where I've noticed I'm a little bit different is I've never defined myself by one thing that I do. So if I have to define myself, I would say I define myself by having the energy and to dare to be creative. I mean, the thing that makes me happy at the end of the day is if I feel I've either made a difference or managed to create something or, you know, shown someone else how to do it. That makes me very happy. And it can be in any genre at all. It really doesn't matter. I don't understand boredom. It just doesn't exist in my, you know, I can't go there. And there's always, I don't have enough time left in my life to do all the things that I'm interested in. And I'm constantly growing and learning and, you know, and I love to hear other people's opinions about things. I really do. I'm not stuck in one opinion. You know, I tell me, what do you think? Oh, really? I don't say you're wrong. You're right. I just, you know, it's interesting. I'm interested, genuinely interested. And I don't think we are that way at the moment. I think that you have to sort of almost at birth take a stance as to who you are and what you stand for and stick by it no matter what or no matter what goes on in the world. And I think, you know, things change, circumstances change. We have to learn and grow with it and also learn that we can change our minds, you know?
Well, that constant curiosity, that flexibility, that openness to learn and to grow and to constantly be a student. I mean, I think those are the things that keep you from becoming rigid and keep you from, you know, like slowly dying inside, you know, over a period of time.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. And you don't have to be an actress to do that. I mean, I was born with flat feet and a speech impediment. I couldn't pronounce my R's. I go, I wound a wugged woxed, a wugged waskles wan. My granddaughter, who's 4, she can't pronounce her R's either. So it's obviously genetic. It's hilarious, actually. It's cute when you're 4, but not so cute when you're older. So I had to learn to go round and roll my R's. I also was sent to a ballet class because I had flat feet. Well, I ended up dancing at the Kirov Ballet, with the Kirov Ballet at Covent Garden when I was 17 years old. And I ended up becoming famous for playing every accent known to man, but especially any form of American accent, which, as we know, relies pretty much entirely on your ability to pronounce your R's.
Absolutely.
So I always tell people, you know, if you have a disability or somebody says, you know, this is what's wrong with you, that's invariably what's actually right with you. I mean, I have a press agent who is in his 80s now, and he's completely dyslexic. It takes him forever to read. What does he do? He's up all night writing scripts. He's one of the best speech writers I've ever known. The guy that's what he does, you know. And I danced and I did, you know, what I did. I mean, it's interesting. What hurts you or what's hard for you often becomes the thing you become best at.
Well, I mean, to be able to take those moments, to take those things and make them your strengths, I mean, that kind of a choice is incredibly empowering. And I mean, that to dance at 17, when you had probably been told like, this is not something that would ever happen. I mean, I can't even imagine the satisfaction that must have created. And also the pattern of, oh, I don't have to believe what people tell me about me.
Yeah,
I can decide.
Exactly. But this is the other part of it. They were actually right. I was not built. My body was not built for ballet. There was a reason I was always being told no, 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 no. The good news is that because I started ballet, I'm very focused. I'm very physical. You know, if I have to learn how to hit a golf ball or ride a horse or, you know, jump on the dodgeball, whatever it is, you know, I understand the physicality because of ballet, classical ballet. There's nothing more physical. The downside was that I injured my knee when I was 17. I couldn't dance anymore. The good news was that the school I was at forced you to do drama, and I was better at acting than I was ballet anyway. And then the other good news was they made a lot of movies in those days in period costume. And because I had a very long back, I looked really good in Victorian clothes because I gave you a very small waist. And no one saw your legs, so they couldn't see whether I had a turnout or not or flat feet. And I was perfectly capable of dancing minuets, waltzes, whatever I was asked to do. So it went full circle, you know.
That was the wave coming back around.
Coming back around. I mean, I went through a terrible divorce when I was 40, and my husband, ex-husband, had lost all our money, left me $9 million in the red with lawsuits from every major bank, including the FDIC. It was in the housing crisis thing. He'd invested all our money and hadn't told me and got me to sign everything, and was uniquely, ridiculously, to a degree of unfaithfulness that we won't even discuss. I had lost everything, homeless, everything. I called my agent and said, I need to work yesterday, and called all the channels. And that time I was at the height of my career. They said, oh, well, if she'll do anything, there's this little movie of the week called Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman, which will never make it as a series, but she has to start tomorrow in less than 12 hours, 24 hours. And then she has to signed for 5 years, even though it'll never be a series because it's a woman in the lead, medical show, family values, Western, tick all the boxes. So that was it. So, you know, every time a challenge has happened, it's turned into an opportunity so many times that, you know, I've even written and published books about it called Remarkable Changes, Turning Life's Challenges into Opportunities, and The Road Ahead and things like that. So, you know, I keep passing on this little tiny piece of information, and I keep meeting people who agree with me or who have done it themselves, like a Christopher Reeve. And, I think that's my inspiration for the times we're in right now.
I mean, that is, you know, the fact that you made those choices when you were faced with these obstacles, you could have given up and I don't think anyone would have blamed you. Of course, she went through this horrible thing. Did you hear what happened? Of course, you know, and you didn't accept that. And so you made those choices. So you made that happen. And yeah, Dr. Quinn is just, it's one of those shows where when it's on, like if you're flipping channels and it's on, you watch it. You know what I mean? Like it's a great show. And it's still, I imagine it's still, you know, like it's, people still watch it today, you know, like, and that show was on 25 years ago, I think, wasn't it?
More. I mean, yes, no more than that. Cause I was 40 when I started it and I'm almost 70 now. So almost 30 years. And the amazing thing about it is that it's very pertinent to what's going on today, as we discussed. But it also really holds up. It's beautifully shot. And because it's in period costume anyway, in period time, it doesn't age. It's, you know, you can make that period piece right now and it would still be period, right? So it does not age at all. And the thing that fascinated me is it's still being shown in 98 countries. Yeah. So think about that. That means 98 countries in this world connect to that material, which is made in America. About what? It's made about a new country where they came, they took over the indigenous people, did not serve them very well, brought in people from many other countries, and made this a new world. And where did they come from? They were all immigrants, every single one of them, except for the Native Americans. And, you know, that's America. And in the rest of the world, they look at this and go, you know, we can relate to this. We can relate to this migration of people because people are migrating everywhere now.
Do you, just because I'm looking at the time and I think I have just a few minutes left with you, so there's a couple more things that I want to ask you about, if that's okay. Yeah. Do you still have St. Catherine's Court?
No, I don't. I sold it just before the crash a number of years ago, whenever that crash was. I don't remember when it was, but it was a big crash. And I realized I couldn't go there often enough and it cost a fortune to maintain. And my then husband, James Keach, said, you know, we've put a fortune into this. We've got huge loans here. I promised you that you'd never be, you know, get in trouble like you did with your previous husband. And, you know, we'd bought his brother's house to try and help him out. So we had loans on that. So we were in a bad place. There was no reason to know there was going to be a crash. But we put them both on the market. We somehow, by some miracle, sold both of them in the same week.
Wow.
For, you know, the right price. And then the market crashed afterwards. So it was providence. It was just as, oh my goodness. But, you know, I cried many tears about losing that house. And I go back to England and I go back and visit it all the time. The owners there, I've never met, but they, part of the provision in selling the house was that I was allowed to go visit my parents' grave, which is in the front garden.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And the church on the property is public property. It's a working church. So, you know, and the neighbors are still the same neighbors. And and I, you know, I'm now very proud of the fact that I spent 25 or 26 years resuscitating a house that was over 1,000 years old. It was built in 950.
It is so stunning. It's one of the most stunning places I've ever seen.
And you know, I brought it back from death. I mean, it literally was dying and crumbling. I never used anybody's public money or national, you know, it could have had all kinds of grants. I did it all personally, everything there. I did it all exactly how you had to do it, you know, grade one listed, all of that. I saved the endangered newts and the endangered bats and I did everything the right way. And you know what? That house will last now for many, many hundreds more years because the person who bought it from me can afford to put even more money into it and maintain it and keep it in the style to which it should be,
that's,
you know, maintained.
Wonderful.
So I feel very good about it. I don't feel like I lost something because I, you know, like, you know, as I said, you don't take anything with you. You just take your memories. And so I have great memories and great pride in the time that and the things that I did for that beautiful house and that beautiful valley.
Well, yeah. And also, you know, there's this idea that it's not about the keep, it's about the having, not about the keeping. Like you had it and you saved it and you breathed life into it. And, you know, we just kind of curate the things that we have anyway, you know, for a brief period of time. And so, you did, you were able to pass it on, you know. I mean, it is literally one of the most stunning places I've ever seen.
It's famous because of OK Computer.
Yes, Radiohead. I was going to ask you about that. Yeah, Radiohead recorded their most famous album at your house.
At my house, I know. And S Club 7 did too. The Cure with that. No, S Club 7 were there. The Cure did two albums there.
Oh, my God.
Johnny Cash was playing there. John Barry, the composer, was playing there. Robbie Williams was there and pretended it was his house for cribs. I mean, yes, there's been very interesting things have happened in that.
Were you present when Radiohead was recording, or did you stay?
No, I wasn't. I rented it out as a place for them to stay. And I knew that from Peter Gabriel, who had his own recording place not far away, that the sound in this one room, this one empty ballroom, was better than any sound anywhere in England. It had 4 second reverberation. So any musician or any sound recordist would come in that room and go, oh my gosh, never, never, never touch this. Don't put a carpet in here. Don't put any furniture in. Don't, you know, you have no idea. This is like some sort of magic thing. And it had a huge high ceiling, but beneath that ceiling, or above it rather, was this huge domed ceiling from hundreds of years earlier. So it had this sort of extraordinary sound. And so, you know, I felt that it was right to share it with musicians. And I also felt for me that it was a place where, I felt, you know, my best art came out of being there, you know, so my best acting. I mean, everything that was creative happened when I was there. And any creative person that came and stayed with us, you know, they just said, oh my goodness, this place has, you know, has something. John Barry used to sit at the end of the garden and he said, Jane, I sit here and I just, you know, all this music's coming in my head. I just, composition after composition, he said, you know, you cannot pass with this place. This place is extraordinary. So it was a very special place. And I'm very glad to have had the experience I had.
That makes me so happy. I've looked at pictures of it online. There's an article in Architectural Digest about it, and I was showing my wife because it is so smack dab in the bullseye of our aesthetic. And yeah. And I looked it up, and I guess you can. I mean, you know, who
you can't rent it. No. It's owned by a Russian gentleman now.
Oh, gotcha. But, no, it
was only rentable when I owned it.
Got it.
And that was a long time ago.
Well, you did an amazing job. I just have to bow in awe at what you did with that place, because it is just storybook. But as we're kind of wrapping this out, I definitely the reason that you came on was to talk about at least that we mentioned War with Grandpa, which is the movie. The cast is amazing, by the way. You and Robert De Niro and Uma Thurman and Christopher Walken and Cheech Marin. I mean, it's like. It's an incredible cast.
It's the most incredible cast of completely different people that you would never expect to have in the same movie, except that, of course, for Chris Walken and Robert De Niro, you know, this was, they'd already worked together rather famously. And Christopher Walken and I had done Wedding Crashers together.
Yes, of course.
I had seen one another in Malibu and maybe playing a little golf once in a while. I didn't know Uma, but she was lovely. And it was just a delightful movie. And I think it's going to be a huge hit. Everyone's loving it. And I can't wait to show it to my grandchildren. I'm going to do that tonight. But I did it because of the cast. And then I read the movie and it really worked. And I thought it was very funny and very cool. And, but, you know, working with that kind of talent and you're all there together and it's almost like an ensemble. Certainly, you know, some of the scenes we were in, everyone would be in together, was just magic. It's the sort of magic you dream of as an actor.
Well, I just can't tell you how much I have enjoyed this conversation. I mean, so inspirational in so many ways. And just hearing that you just don't take shit from life is such a great, I mean, just sort of hearing your journey and hearing, you know, even briefly some of the things that you've done and not settling and turning obstacles into opportunities. I mean, these are all the things that I and the people I think want and need to hear right now. And also contribution and, you know, connecting and mental health. And there's just so many wonderful things that we talked about.
Well, I appreciate that. And have people check out openheartsfoundation.org and they can see what we're doing with the Young Hearts app. And we hopefully, this is going to be not only national but international, that we will be able to have this. This will be the go-to place for organizations and volunteers, and we will be connecting people. And of course, you know, the interesting sidebar to this is that if you connect doing something that is for other people and it's filling, it's your passion and it's something you can make a difference with, the chances of you bumping into someone similar are pretty huge.
Yes.
Yes, I just say that.
Yes. Well, again, thank you so much.
That was fun. I'm looking forward to it. I hope I get a copy of this podcast or they tell me how I find it.
Oh, absolutely. But until then, I say the end.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.